ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What do Rasputin, Tupac, and Pharaoh Ramses III have in common? No, it's not the weirdest boy band ever. They all met their end at the hand of an assassin. From seizing power to silencing dissidents, Assassins unpacks the moments in which someone decides that murder is the move. Search for Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a very personal question, Priya. Do you snore?
I don't. If Will was here, he sometimes says if I'm very, very tired, but I'm not a day-to-day snorer. That's quite a personal question.
It's a very personal question. But, you know, people often confuse snoring with sleep apnea. They think sleep apnea is all about snoring.
Yes, but it can exist without snoring. It can exist in snorers, but it's not all about the noise.
Yeah. I'm a snorer. I'll just confess. So I've got a lie on my side. So I've got this bruise on my back
from
somebody who hits me whenever I snore. But I don't have sleep apnea, as far as I know, anyway. But sleep apnea is one of the things, and diagnosing it and getting the diagnosis wrong because of the technology is one of the things we're going to be talking about on today's Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land,
and I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, when a couple is struggling to conceive, historically women have been the focus of infertility discussions, but new guidelines shift the focus to men.
It's often a combined thing, isn't it?
With
women and men, and men get
sidelined, not anymore.
Now, getting a joint replacement is a big operation, but how many knee replacements do you think occur each year in Australia, Priya?
I'm going to have a complete guess, 70,000.
Well, pretty good, actually. There's 70,000 hip replacements and 85,000 knee replacements.
You owe me chocolate.
A lot, that's right. It's a lot. But, you know, they don't last forever. How long will they last? And there are some hidden surprises.
If you're a new parent, you might have seen these allergy starter kits advertised, which promise to help you introduce these allergy foods safely. But do they have evidence behind them?
In news this week, well, let's just depart, Priya, from our normal practice, because I wanted to return to a story we did last week, which got a lot of response on peanut allergy and how it was reducing.
Yes.
In following early introduction of solids to children and early introduction of these allergenic foods. And you had an experience this week.
I did.
To share it.
I called you from the clinic, didn't I? Because I saw a patient who had had an allergic reaction to what is now called an allergy starter pack. So introducing some of these common allergy-causing foods, but not in the traditional way. And for once, I can say not like I did it in the old days, because I feel old. So when my kids were small, and they're only 9 and 5, I introduced the egg, the peanut protein, doing mashed up stuff and peanut paste and smooth stuff. Now, a lot of parents and caregivers are using these allergy starter packs, sachets of egg, peanut, the other stuff.
And the question is, do they work? What ones should you buy? And to answer those questions, we've got Professor Mimi Tang, who is a paediatric immunologist and allergist at the Royal Children's Hospital and the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. So Mimi, welcome to the Health Report. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Before we get to these starter packs, let's just talk about the data here. So last week we talked about the American study, which showed significant reductions following the change in food introduction guidelines. And we weren't aware of Australian data at that point, but you've got Australian data on the effects in Australia.
Yes, we do. We've actually looked in two different ways. So we have examined food anaphylaxis admissions across Australia using national admissions data, and that's been showing some very interesting findings. We had guideline changes twice in Australia, one in 2008, where we said no longer avoid, because, you know, historically we were telling everybody to delay the introduction of allergenic solids. And in 2008, ASCIA came out with updated guidance that said, look, there's no evidence to delay, so let's not tell people to do that anymore. So we removed that recommendation. And then in 2016, after two major studies, we updated the guidance further to say actively introduce allergenic solids from around 6 months of age, but if possible, within the first year of life. And we tracked anaphylaxis admissions across Australia over three time periods, before 2008, 2008 to 2016, and then 2016 to initially 2019, but we've recently published out to 2022. And the message is very clear. There is slowing in food anaphylaxis admissions. The absolute number of admissions is still going up, but instead of going up in an exponential trajectory, it's basically flattening. You know, these are early days, but we think the trial setting is obviously very different to the real world setting. And perhaps it's a little bit more confusing for parents for what to do. There may be more reluctance without the strong support of a clinical trial team, and or it might be that it simply isn't as effective in less high-risk patient populations, because generally speaking, the trials that have been completed have been conducted in high-risk populations.
So normally, maybe when people introduce these foods, they were doing it with the actual food itself, so some peanut paste or some egg. Now a lot of people are relying on these starter packs, which they can get either online or at a pharmacy. Are they effective? Is there evidence showing that they're as good as doing it with solid food or better than?
So, I mean, what we do have is very strong evidence that introducing allergenic solids in the first year of life can significantly reduce the risk of developing food allergy. But what's less clear is the exact amount and the frequency that is required for a protective effect to be achieved. So the large trials, LEAP and EAT, that I mentioned earlier, they used an intervention of a fairly high and frequent dosing. So they were suggesting 2 grams of allergen protein. So that's not weight of the food, that's the protein content of the allergen in the food. 2 grams of that, 2 to 3 times a week, depending on the study that you were looking at.
So it's not nothing.
No, it's not nothing at all. And what's interesting, actually, it's about a standard serve. So to give you context, 2 grams of peanut protein is what you'd get in a teaspoon of peanut butter or one of those little sachets. So it's about a standard serve for a baby, right? I mean, you spread that over a piece of toast and the baby nibbles on it. In the case of egg, it's probably about an egg. So when we say 2 grams 2 to 3 times a week, that's a weekly dose of about 4 to 6 grams of allergenic protein. Now, the EAT study also then did an analysis to see if there was a dose effect, and they did indeed find evidence of that. They found that a dose of around 2 grams a week was actually having a beneficial effect, not to the same degree as 4 grams in their study, but certainly it was having an effect. So that's the first thing. The second is...
So just to capture that, so that's the more the better... 2 grams still had an effect, but if you're doing less than 2 grams, you may not be getting much of an effect at all, presumably.
Correct. That's actually spot on. And then there's another piece to it, which is frequency. And some studies are suggesting that, you know, although LEAP and EAT did 2 to 3 times a week, those that were going 4 to 5 times a week also seemed to be getting a little bit more benefit. So the point about these new products, I think a number of these are coming out because the aim is to make introduction for families easier. My concern is I'm not 100% convinced these products are achieving that goal. So the background for why they wanted to make it easier is in the EAT study, you know, only around a third of patients enrolled in the study or families enrolled in the study actually succeeded in introducing 5 of the 6 foods at amounts that were 3 grams a week instead of 4 grams a week for at least 5 weeks instead of the proposed 8 weeks. So you can already see, right, they've dropped the bar for what protocol was recommending, and yet only a third of those patients were able to achieve that.
And that's in a trial where you're being watched over and cajoled.
Because you're tired and it's hard work and you've got a child. So it's not easy. So the starter packs are there to really make it much more achievable for parents. But the question is, are they getting a high enough dose? Are we actually reducing the risk? Yeah.
Correct. So I mean, that's my take on it. I'm not convinced that they actually make things easier for the families. I mean, the first point is that, as you've said, the doses in the majority of products are much, much lower than that 4 to 6 grams a week that was trialled, or even the 2 grams a week that through post-hoc analyses is shown to be of benefit. There is one product actually that was developed based on the LEAP trial by one of the LEAP investigators. It's peanut puffs basically, and they do have in each packet 2 gram serving. So, and then they do have another product of mixed nuts that has the right dosing as well. But I'll come to that point about mixed foods. It's a separate thing.
That's actually what I was going to ask you. Is it possible, because these are artificial supplementary foods, that they could actually paradoxically have an adverse effect rather than the whole food, which is mixed with all sorts of natural compounds, which could actually affect the immune system in their own right?
Well, that's a very complicated question. The first thing I would say is we know that babies who have a more diverse diet and foods prepared at home during the early years of life have lower rates of food allergy than those who do not. We also know that processed foods are not generally favourable for healthy immune metabolic programming through your life. So on a more general level, one would think pushing in a direction of medicalized supplements really may not be in the right direction. Because what I was going to say was, look, we know it's difficult. What we need to do is to make it easier for families. And whilst the aim of these products is to make it easier, I'm not sure that happens. The reason being, it sort of ends up being, oh, I have to take this supplement, as against just introducing normal foods in standard serves that the family likes to eat and then keeping them in the diet for the baby. The main thing is to introduce one food at a time so you can identify if there is an allergy. That's my advice usually to my patients.
Thank you so much, Mimi. That's been incredibly insightful. Thank you so much for your time.
Professor Mimi Tang, who is at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, a paediatric immunologist and allergist.
Last week, we did a story in the news section about shingles vaccination and a reduced risk of heart disease, and you just wanted to make a correction.
Yeah, this is a kind of mea culpa. We normally declare clearly how reliable the study is and if it's important who the sponsor is, and we didn't do that in this case. So, in fact, this was an abstract at a conference, so not a peer-reviewed paper. And it seems that the vaccine manufacturer, GlaxoSmithKline, was the one who sponsored the research. And we've said many times on the show, when you've got the manufacturer sponsoring research, you tend to get a more positive result, or you're more likely to get a positive result. So we just wanted to say it may well be right. It looked like a reliable study, but we just wanted to put that caveat. We should have done it last week. Now we've done it.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
So I'm tantalised by this male infertility story that you've got, because I always thought that they'd got all that together, but clearly not.
Yes, so 1 in 9 Australian couples actually experience infertility, and often the spotlight tends to be on the woman. So when infertility is being investigated, it's the woman who tends to go through lots of testing and hysteroscopy and referrals. But now there's the first ever Australian guidelines for male infertility, which gives a bit of a framework, aims to reduce some of the stigma. I spoke with Professor Robert McLaughlin, who's Medical Director of Healthy Male and Consultant Andrologist for the Monash IVF program.
30 years ago, the man was rarely seen. His partner was given a sperm jar and, get John to fill that up for me and away we go. That's not acceptable. And we have worked for 20 years to try and change the culture in conjunction with the major societies that oversee this care. And it's a little bit diverse because they may see a urologist, they may see an IVF specialist, who's usually a gynecologist, or they may see a hormone specialist, an endocrinologist, like I was originally. So it's a bit of a broad church because there's no single person that necessarily sees all the couples.
This is the first ever male infertility guideline of its kind in Australia. Why is it so essential, and what are you hoping that it's going to change on the ground?
The development of these guidelines really comes out of the recognition that male infertility is a very common and important problem. It's a major independent cause of infertility and a contributor to infertility, such that maybe half of cases have a male sole factor or contributory factor. So it's a big deal. We also know that there are reversible causes within that group of people, and also that there are diseases which are more common in those men. Now, that compels you to realize that men need to be seen. They need to be evaluated, just like their partner. They have health concerns which must be addressed. So we've had to work with the different societies, and we've had some success over the years. We've developed a system now where the outcomes of IVF in Australia are recorded according to the reason the man was infertile. We also have recognition in the guidelines that oversee IVF programs that their clinical service must include evaluation of the male, either within or through collaboration. But one further step from that is to look at the evidence of what best practice is. And the Europeans and the Americans have been doing this for a long time, and they have very creditable guidelines, which they have done all the work on. And so what we've done is to take those guidelines and filter them through an Australian lens, if you like, to see what's relevant, the health resources available within Australia, so that we've come up with 80 guidelines for best practice. And of course, the hope is that this will improve care. I mean, that's where we're heading, right?
You just said before, Robert, though, that it's been quite common in a heterosexual couple that the woman tends to have the spotlight on her and the male partner might be handed a semen analysis. What is the recommendation now? Is it that if in a heterosexual couple there are fertility issues that both get investigated at the same time now?
Yes.
And what does that look like?
Well, it means meeting the man. It means talking about his medical history, examining him and doing some basic tests. Now, clearly that will involve a semen test, but also often the hormonal levels that control the testis and potentially other tests depending upon what they show. So occasionally you get serious diseases which present with male infertility. And I have had some classic examples in the past of men who have come along with a very low sperm count. And that was due to the fact that their pituitary gland wasn't working to drive the testicle because they had a pituitary tumour. You know, that's worth knowing about, right? So the care changes on a dime there. Or you have men with a blockage to sperm flow, which may be surgically remediable. So there are important things you might pick up. Another perspective of this is, gender fairness, because if you don't assiduously look for a male factor and you say, oh, well, there's enough sperm for an IVF attempt, we'll do that. What you're doing is putting the female partner potentially through an unnecessary experience. I mean, IVF is not free fun, or it's a hard work, right? So you want to avoid that. So there's that aspect. And as I also said before, there are some conditions such as testicular cancer or testosterone deficiency, which are much more common in this group of men. You need to know about that. So that's why it's mandatory in these guidelines to see the guy and do these evaluations.
A lot of women will go and see a GP for a preconception consult, so before they even try to conceive. Do men need to think about anything in particular, preconception, before you even try to get pregnant, in order to improve, I can see you getting excited, improve semen quality, to increase the chances of conception? Tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the major recognitions of the last 10 years is preconception planning is a thing for men. You know, you only use your sperm to make a baby 1, 2, 3, 4 times in your whole lifetime. You have a responsibility to make sure that that sperm is in its optimal health. Now, if you are smoking or you're way overweight or you have other diseases which need to be addressed, it can negatively impact those sperm and therefore your offspring. So there's plenty of animal data, but also human data, that if you are overweight and diabetic and poorly controlled, the offspring that you have will be imprinted with some of those adverse long-term health consequences. Now, what guy doesn't want to give his child the best chance of a healthy life? So there are two people involved here now. You've got the guy who's got poorly controlled diabetes, or he's overweight, or he's smoking and doing bad things. It's going to shorten his life expectancy. But as well as that, the baby that he aspires to have could get a negative impact from what he's doing. So we clearly do that. It's been true for women for years. Welcome to the club, guys, preconception planning. So when you're thinking about making a baby, you need to get ahead of the game and look after yourself early on.
What I was really hoping to actually touch on was just the stigma, because it tends to be the woman that gets over-investigated and hysteroscopies and then IVF, and the male just, I say to them, has your partner gone and seen their GP and had a semen analysis? And they're like, oh, no.
I think that stigma is declining because you talk about it more. We're talking about it. The newspaper talks about it. 20 years ago, we didn't. So people recognise male infertility as a thing now, and I hope that stigma is declining. You know, it's nobody's fault. It just happens. I'm not sure male infertility is getting more common, you know, biologically, which is a question about, you know, sperm counts falling and the like. There is evidence for that, although it's kind of inconsistent and geographically different. So I'm not quite sure. But we talk about it more because we can do more. Microinjection IVF was 1992, so that's 32 years ago. Before that, many of these people, there was no prospect of having a child, the most severe cases, because the sperm weren't adequate for normal IVF. Now, as you know, with blockages or all sorts of difficult situations, they can have normal children through IVF. And that means people in the past who might have been reticent to even come forward and know that there's a potential avenue for them to have a child together. And one of, I guess, the most remarkable example, which is really a game changer, is the case of Klinefelter syndrome, which is the commonest problem in Australian genetic, chromosomal genetic in men. It's one in 550 men, roughly. That's a lot of men. Virtually all have a zero sperm count and testosterone deficiency. And they inevitably, if they wanted to have a family, was adoption or donor sperm. That's the only way they had. Now, up to 60% of them, with a surgical operation, you can go into the testicle and find sperm within the very small testes and use them. And those sperm are normal, interestingly, even though most of their body has the chromosomal imbalance of an extra X chromosome, the stem cells in the little tiny pockets in their testicle are 46XY, normal chromosomes. So the most remarkable thing that one sees now is the Klinefelter's gentleman who brings in his two genetic children to show you. And after he finished having his treatment, he goes on testosterone therapy, which he needed all the way through. And he's feeling fantastic. So he bounces in to see you saying, I feel so well. Have you met my children? I mean, 30 years ago, you got to be kidding.
Yeah.
And now it can happen. So, you know, the fact that so many things can be done now, I think, brings people forward.
That was Professor Robert McLaughlin, who's the Medical Director of Healthy Male.
You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National.
Coming up later in the show, it turns out the device that measures your oxygen levels through the device on your finger might not be as effective if you've got darker skin. It might mean you don't get diagnosed with sleep apnea, potentially.
And you might also get underdiagnosed in terms of how sick you are.
Relevant to me, because I'm a brown bear.
There are about 70,000 hip replacements a year in Australia, 85,000 knee replacements, probably about 10,000 shoulder replacements, so shoulders are growing in time. And we have a world-leading register of joint replacements in Australia, and it started off because we had a high redo rate in Australia. So in other words, taking out the old joint and putting in another one than other countries in the world. And of course, when you do that, first of all, there's pain, complications, expense for the person, but it also means an orthopaedic surgeon who could be doing X number of new knee replacements helping people with knee arthritis are actually spending their time doing redos. And the National Joint Replacement Registry has just published its latest data and showing that the numbers of redos are going up. But there's a catch here, as you'll find out. So I thought I'd actually use this as an excuse to find out where we're at with hip and knee replacements and what the redo rate is and the things that you should watch out for. And the person I spoke to was Dr. Peter Lewis, who's an orthopaedic surgeon and deputy director of the Australian Orthopaedic Association's National Joint Replacement Registry.
The revision burden, as it's termed, was roughly 10% of the total number of hip replacements done in the year. Over time, that's slowly come down, and now our revision burden is 6% or so. In Sweden, it's around 4 to 5%, and I think that's what we should be aiming to get toward.
Now, this is a different question from the one a person might ask who's going to have their hip done or their knee or even their shoulder. Because what I'd want to know is, Dr. Lewis is doing my knee this week or my hip. How long is that going to last?
When we look at the registry results, we know that 8% of both hips and knees are revised by 20 years using our modern prostheses. So conversely, that means 92% by 20 years haven't needed another operation. So we can quite confidently say to most people that the chances of you needing another operation by 20 years are less than 1 in 10. That does change with the patient's age, and it does change with the patient's comorbidity and obesity and some other factors.
When the Joint Replacement Registry started, one of the reasons postulated for the high revision rate for Australia internationally was that orthopaedic surgeons were just making their own decisions about which joint was best. They had their belief systems. Sometimes it was joints that they'd invented. Sometimes there were mixing manufacturer there and people having their favourite joints and believing they were great. And my understanding for the reason that the revision rate has come down from the sound of it by about 40 or 50% is that consumers and surgeons realised that some of these joints were crap and they needed to go with the joints that were high performing. Is my memory of that accurate?
Fairly good, Norm. What we do try and point out to surgeons and patients too is that there are a bunch of prostheses that do well and a bunch of prostheses that don't do so well, and there's a bunch of techniques which do better than others in general. So we try to give people guidance on better things to do for their patients, the better prostheses to use and the better techniques to put them in with.
Now, these latest data suggest there's been an uptick in revision rate.
Yeah, there's been an increase in numbers. If you look at the raw number of revision procedures last year and compare that to what it was, say, 20 years ago, there's been about a 5 times increase in the number of revision hip procedures and a 6 times increase in the number of revision knee procedures over that 20-year period or so. But at the same time, there's been a much larger increase in numbers of primary procedures being done. So the raw numbers don't really reflect the true case in that we're doing fewer revisions per primary procedure in 2024.
Give me a flavour of the sort of joint replacements that are performing well and the sort of procedures, because already we're hearing of knee surgeons moving to robotic surgery. And for the life of me, I can't work out what advantage you'd get from robotic surgery of the knee, given it's not like the abdomen or the heart where you're delving inside the body. But give me a sense of all that.
Okay, the prostheses have changed over time and we've now got better quality polyethylene bearings. And there's been subtle changes in prosthesis shape and designs and things that have also added slightly.
I've only ever seen one knee replacement. And what was impressive about it, well, first of all, just had no idea what to expect, but was that there was a jig and they were lining things up quite carefully via the jig before they put in the holes for the screws and so on. And clearly, once upon a time, that was probably done by eye, but now it's done mechanically.
Yeah, there's a technique called computer navigation where we orientate the cutting components by using like a GPS system. And that has been quite common for knees and much less common for hips. When we've looked at the results of that, though, there hasn't been a vast improvement or any real change in the outcome with regard to revision. There's also another technique where the patient's images are sent off and some customised cutting components are made, and that's called image-derived instrumentation and does seem to help the placement of the acetabular component in a hip replacement. But when we look at the results in knee replacement, it's actually not much different at all from using mechanical instruments. And perhaps in the older patients, the results are actually a little bit poorer. And then thirdly, there's a technique where we use a robotic arm and it operates a cutting component. When we've looked at the results of that, the results of robotic-assisted surgery so far have not been any different from using mechanical instruments in knee replacements. And they're perhaps a little bit worse in hip replacements. So far, it's a tool that's fun for the surgeon to play with, but the patient hasn't seen any great advances.
And what about infection rates?
Unfortunately, with time, the infection rate has very slightly increased over time, and we're not really certain why that is. But now we're getting more of the late acute infections where people have a septic source elsewhere, and then that seeds the joint replacement that previously had been working well for years. Between 1.5% and 2% of people get infections.
Over the lifetime of their joint?
Yes.
What are the common myths and misbeliefs people have about, say, knee replacements?
Many people still think that their replacement is going to feel and behave like a 20-year-old's knee. So many times people get disappointed that they can't jump and jog like they once could. But they do work very, very well for most daily things. And especially for the people in the age group that receive joint replacements, they're not wanting to do extreme sports in general.
Dr. Peter Lewis, an orthopaedic surgeon and deputy director of the National Joint Replacement Registry. So now you know everything there is to know.
And have you changed your mind?
No, I'm still going to limp on with my Pilates and everything else.
We're limping here on ABC Radio National. You're with the Health Report.
We have in the ABC what's called the Top 5 program. So we choose 5 early to mid-career scientists to come into the ABC and they learn about the media and broadcasting and communication. But they're really interesting people in their own right. That's why they've been chosen. And one of our top 5 this year is Dr. Amal Osman, who's a postdoctoral researcher at Flinders University. And her particular interest, her special interest, sounds like a quiz program, is sleep apnea. But she's also been working on this pulse oximeter and the problem that certain people with brown or dark skin may not have their oxygen level measured properly. Here's Amal.
Pulse oximeters transmit 2 wavelengths of light, infrared and red, to estimate blood oxygen levels. And actually, this is evidence that's been known for about 50 years, but there's been more interest in it recently. It has shown that in people with dark skin, the values that the pulse oximeters report are incorrect. There's a consistent overestimation of the actual blood oxygen level.
Really? So you could be seriously under-oxygenated, but if you've got black skin, it'll tell you you're looking fine.
Yes. Black patients are 3 times more likely to have what they call occult hypoxemia, which is hidden hypoxemia. So their oxygen saturation levels on the pulse oximeter shows a normal range when it's actually less than 88%, which is levels that require urgent medical intervention.
What research have you done in this area?
So we use pulse oximeters to diagnose sleep apnea and measure sleep apnea severity. And there's no way to diagnose sleep apnea without these devices.
Meaning it might not be so clear to see that you've stopped breathing, but your blood oxygen drops.
Yeah, so when we are measuring sleep apnea, we have 2 different breathing events. The airway could completely close and you have no airflow for about 10 seconds to up to a minute. Or your airway becomes very small and you're trying to breathe, you're not getting enough air in. But what happens is you have what we call a cortical arousal or brief awakening that you're not aware of, or you have reductions in your oxygen levels. And so this is how we detect these breathing events that we call hypopneas, so it's reduced airflow. So for black patients, if your hypopneas are not sensitive enough to lead to an oxygen desaturation because of this issue with inaccuracy with pulse oximeters, then it's likely that your sleep apnea severity might be underestimated or you might have misdiagnosis of your sleep apnea.
So has anybody developed a pulse oximeter that can, presumably it's to do with the color of the skin and the infrared is not picking up the blood supply?
Yes, so higher melanin in people with black skin is likely absorbing some of the light that should be transmitted.
So this is reminiscent of stories we've done where women are neglected in medical research and under-researched top to bottom, even in the laboratory. Even laboratory animals tend to be more male than female. So it sounds remarkable that the medical device industry has produced a device which is designed for white people.
Yep. So these devices are designed to work optimally in people with light skin. One of the reasons that this has happened is because when the US Food and Drug Administration, they had guidelines for when these devices are being calibrated, and it was to have 10 participants and only 2 need to be darkly pigmented with no guidance on what darkly pigmented means. Or if you have a larger sample, then 15% should be darkly pigmented.
So if they had a sample of people who had darker skin, why didn't they pick it up?
They likely looked at the average for the whole group and assumed that skin pigmentation wasn't going to be an issue with these devices.
So this is scary.
Yes.
So it's scary in the ED, scary in the intensive care unit, and scary if you're actually trying to find sleep apnea. Does the technology exist to do surface oxygen monitoring designed for dark skin?
At the moment, there are new devices that are being developed. A recent one is a laser-based device, but it's very early development and early stages at this point. The FDA has introduced new guidelines earlier this year where they now require 150 participants to be studied and for these new devices to be tested on, and 25% who are darkly pigmented, and they have new standards for how you judge that. So they want both subjective assessments using a skin tone scale and more objective assessments as well.
So if someone's listening to us, and their GP's sending them off to a sleep clinic to have a sleep study for apnea, and their Indian ethnicity, Bangladeshi or African-American ancestry, what's the question they need to ask of the sleep physician so that they're not wasting their time and money?
I think if they're told that they don't have a sleep diagnosis, it's important if they have the symptoms and they're there for a good reason, it's important to investigate further and maybe look at the airflow signals a little bit more closely, because I've talked about how this issue exists in patients who are Black, but there's also evidence that people who have what they classify as intermediate skin tone, there's almost like a dose error. So people with light skin, they have the most accurate, and then people with darker skin have more error, and then Black people have the most error. So there is
a reason
to...
that's a very subjective criterion. And you can have people who are African-American origin.
Yes.
And they have a wide range.
Absolutely.
Of skin tone themselves, as do ethnic Indians.
They do. So there are several limitations for many of these studies, the biggest being that most of the studies self-reported race. So we need more studies where we carefully measure skin tone and see how this relates to health outcomes.
But the consumer question is, when you're going in for an expensive sleep test and you've got brown or black skin, ask them how they're going to measure your oxygen levels and whether you know what sleep apnea.
Yes. I'm leading a study at the moment trying to answer this question. It involves having a new approach to measure whether this error exists and how the extent to exist and how it impacts our sleep studies. We will be looking at different pulse oximeters, all being measured at the same time, and we'll see how low these oxygen desaturations go.
And by desaturation, you mean decline in oxygen levels?
Yes, with the respiratory event. So when someone stops breathing during sleep, comparing people who are Black and people who are white and seeing what their responses are with the pulse oximeter.
Look forward to the results.
Thank you.
Dr. Mal Osman is postdoctoral researcher at Flinders University and one of the ABC's top five scientists for 2025. Had you ever heard this before, Priya, that it doesn't work as well, say, like you, Indian ethnicity?
Yes, I have had these discussions before, and we also note it with people if they've got certain nails on or nail polish.
Oh, really?
So I sometimes get terrified if I'm ever in an emergency and I've had my nails painted.
So you got a double whammy, brown
skin
and
brown
painted
and
nails.
Genuinely, I've had these discussions around the dinner table.
You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National. So what's in the mailbag?
We've got some nice emails this week. So Anne has written in and said, thanks for the segment with Dr. Gemma Sharp. And that ran last week where we talked about weight stigma in healthcare, discussions about weight in general practice in Australia. Anne says, I'm a GP early in my career. Welcome, Anne. I have lived experience of an eating disorder.
I think we're getting more GPs listening since you've been presenting the program.
That's a good thing, Norman.
Is
That's
it?
A good thing.
Okay.
It is.
I'm sure it is.
Oh, you sound skeptical.
No,
my
it
goodness.
Is. It's good. I love GPs.
I have lived experience of an eating disorder, so I talk to many patients about disordered eating and body image issues. I think, unfortunately, we still live in a society that idealises thinness and promotes disordered eating, and I wholeheartedly agree. I have prescribed semaglutide for one patient who had an active eating disorder and lives in a larger body. I only did this after we had established a good relationship. She was open about her eating disorder thoughts and behaviours, and she had a treatment team who supported the plan. I was so relieved to hear Dr. Sharp saying she thinks that GLP-1s can be safely used for patients like mine. I've followed her research for years and trust her as an authority on this.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Anne.
And just a bit of decoding there, semaglutide is Ozempic or Wegovy. That's the active ingredient. And the next one's from Kelly,
who says, I really wish that transcranial magnetic stimulation was more available for people. So that was TMS and the story you did about at-home TMS for depression.
Yeah, and in the clinic. It was mostly about in the clinic TMS, but that's right.
I clearly didn't listen. So Kelly
says... So Priya, do you listen to the health
Yeah, report? I do. I actually do. But sometimes I tune out, Norman, because I'm also doing the washing. Alas. Kelly, the first time I received it, I went from actively battling suicidal ideation every waking moment and many sleeping moments to not having the ideation at all after fewer than 10 treatments of standard TMS. I was discharged after 4 weeks. This lasted more than 4 years. I was also able to drop medication doses during that time.
And interestingly, Kelly's actually so committed, she's prepared to take part in a randomised controlled trial where they're giving a drug in addition to transcranial magnetic stimulation to see whether or not you get better results. So well done, Kelly. And just worth saying before we go on is it's really, if you've got a chronic problem, whether it's heart disease, whether it's migraine, whatever it is, and the current drugs aren't doing that well for you, you should be asking whether, you know, particularly if you're seeing a non-GP specialist, is there a clinical trial open for my condition? And particularly in cancer, we really, you know, people do better on a clinical trial in cancer than not. So you should, it's really worth finding out whether there are clinical trials on because you're highly likely to benefit from it. There is a website, a government website about active clinical trials that you can find out about clinical trials for your condition. And we'll have a link to that in our show notes. Just a hobby horse of mine that a lot of clinical trials don't get going because people, they can't recruit people. And
People don't know about them. I often share them on my social media. If they're reputable, because people don't know about them.
They don't.
Yeah. So well I'm done. Helping the cause, Norman.
You are. And one of the things that Paul Fitzgerald, who we had on last week, the expert in transcranial magnetic stimulation, talked about the limited availability of repeat treatments with TMS. You know, Kelly also says there is a rebate for a single repeat treatment of transcranial magnetic stimulation. But there's a limit to how many repeats that you can get. And Paul's point was, well, there are no limits to lots of other treatments. Why should there be with TMS? But thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly. Can I add one to the mailbag, Norman, which came through the corridor at the ABC for me today from Damien Carrick, who hosts the Law Report.
Right.
Who said that he loved our session on rosacea and is actually treating his rosacea now with over-the-counter therapies from the episode.
Well, now that you've added a mailbag, let me add one. One of my close friends who has rosacea said to me that she got more out of your conversation with the University of Melbourne dermatologist than she's got out of two dermatologists in her own experience.
Interestingly, Damien said something similar. So we're doing something right here.
We are.
Yeah, if you have topics you want us to cover, please tell us, or just nice things or suggestions or corrections, anything, we'll take it all. The address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, Watch That Rash, which this week we're looking at lead in protein powder. Just when you thought it was safe to go out,
there's lead.
Screw you over with your protein powder.
I don't use any, do you?
No.
Oh, there you go. I'll listen anyway. See you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.